Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives.
And today's guest is absolutely no different, and I think you will be really quite moved by the content of what she has to share. I am very pleased to introduce to you author Maya W. Tyler. Maya has written a book entitled Bounce Back Better, How to Win After a Great Loss. Maya, welcome to Mind Talk.
Hi, thank you very much.
Now, Maya, you are described as an author, a speaker, I've seen those titles before, and a happiness advocate. I haven't seen that one before.
Yes, happiness advocate, I'm one of those people that I think everything I do is centered around whether or not that's part of who I am, part of moving forward, something that makes me happy. And through my experiences, I've learned that that's important. And so I try to help other people self-actuate, try to help other people figure out what it is that makes them happy, and help them figure out how to fit that in their lives, because it is, like I said, very important.
It's critically important. I agree with you, and a lot of people don't recognize how much a part of mental health and wellness is the ability to know who you are, to follow that path, and to incorporate it in your life, whether you can do it full-time, part-time, whatever time, but to have some time in your life that really is designed and allows you to be fully happy with what you're doing and with who you are.
I agree.
Now, today, Maya, you are in your early 30s. You were also going on your 8th year as a widow, a single mom of two, and a depression anxiety disorder survivor.
Yes.
Your memoir is Bounce Back Better, is about moving forward, about embracing today and tomorrow. But I'd like for us to start a bit in your past. Tell us about your teenage years, just for a moment. Where were you living? With whom were you living? Those kinds of things.
My teenage years were pretty typical. I lived with both my parents. I'm probably the only kid from that era whose parents were not divorced, so I felt I was probably teased a little bit as the Cosby kid. So I did just about every activity under the sun. I was a cheerleader, ROTC, swim team, gospel choir, just everything.
So you name it, you did it.
Yes, pretty much. I was busy. My mom worked in the school system, so she kept me busy.
All right, wise woman. Now, as a teenager, did you have goals or dreams for what your life would be like?
I knew in some aspect I wanted to write. I didn't really have an idea of how I was going to actualize that, but I knew I wanted to write. I wrote all the time. I wrote songs and poems and entered contests and things like that. So I knew I wanted to write.
And what did your parents want for you?
Both of my parents were pretty supportive about whatever it was that made me happy. They definitely instilled in me the encouragement I needed to be okay with whatever it is I am.
That's wonderful. That's an important piece for parents in general. And again, it's something that so many don't quite have a handle on how to do. Tell us about your dating life as a teenager. Did you date?
I was not allowed to date until I was about 16. And dating, we have to use that word loosely, because it meant being in a large group of other teenagers that my parents picked me up from.
Okay. So sounds like safe dating from your parents' perspective. Okay. Yes. Tell us when you met your husband.
I met him when I was 18. Do you want to go into detail about what that was like?
Absolutely. How did you meet him? Where did you meet him? What were your first impressions?
Wow. When I met Jason, I was in the mail room at my college. I was a freshman in college. And there's a big room at Virginia State University. So there's this big room where you go and pick up your mail. And I was there and trying to find my mailbox. And I heard this voice saying thank you to someone who had told him happy birthday. And I turned around and I saw him and I thought, you know, he's cute. It wasn't like a, you know, moment or anything, but I was thinking, I really want to talk to him, or I want him to see me and notice me. But as he was, you know, responding to the person that spoke to him, I realized he was an upperclassman. I realized he was also, he was wearing, you know, Alpha Phi Alpha paraphernalia. So I realized he was, you know, kind of a known figure on campus and, you know, frat guy. And so I'm like, oh, well, I you know, I'm just no one, this new freshman that just got here. So the first thing I could think of was to also tell him happy birthday. So I walked past him, wished him happy birthday, and that was it. That was it. I didn't talk to him again until I was at a party, and things grew from the party. They went from there.
And were you still a freshman at that party?
Yes.
Okay.
It was a couple of months later, and I was still a freshman, yes. And he actually, there's a funny story about the conversation that I had after that. The way that we really got talking at the party was, growing up in Upper Marlboro, I had no idea, and, you know, growing up with kind of a sheltered parenting, I never watched things like School Days or knew anything about, you know, that Black culture of college life.
Okay.
Neither of my parents pledged any sororities or fraternities, so I didn't know anything about it.
And you grew up in Upper Marlboro, which is in Maryland?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, you know, though they both went to college, they did not pledge. I didn't know anybody that did. So it was interesting seeing it in college and not fully understanding, but, you know, there's kind of a stigma about asking questions. Well, not me. I decided I wanted to be, you know, what I had seen on the yard, and I loved it. I wanted to be an alpha, and I did not realize at the time that it was all male in the fraternity. So I expressed interest to him of being an alpha, and he just looks at me like, like, no, I'm sorry, I don't think we can do that for you. And it started our conversation, and, you know, that was the first kind of the first page of our lives.
And tell me your impressions of him as you began to know him. What kind of person did you see him to be?
Oh, wow. He was a unique person. One of those people that, like, everyone knows them, everyone loves them. He just had, like, this superior, all-knowledgeable. He was a very articulate, very poised, just seemed mature beyond his years, and but extremely kind and extremely personable. You know, he had to touch the shoulder of anyone he was talking to. He had to, you know, make sure that he went above and beyond if he was helping somebody. He was the dean, actually, of the president of the chapter for Alpha Phi Alpha at the school, and he was constantly had his hands in all kinds of leadership and student body government and charity type things. So he was just awesome.
he sounds like quite the guy. What did your parents think of him?
They didn't meet him until we did not start dating, actually, until I had known him, and we had become very close friends after about 2 years. So they didn't meet him until, about maybe 2 years. And when they did meet him, they thought he was a great guy. They were like, oh, wow, where'd you find him?
And you said in the mail room.
Yeah, in the mail room. Tried to be an alpha.
So it really does sound like one of those almost storybook kind of chance meetings that was meant to be a friendship that grew into a relationship that grew into a marriage.
Yes, it was.
What were your goals for yourself and for your married life together as you married?
He was heavily involved in personal development and network marketing. And because he had this, you know, big vision, he wanted to be financially free, and he wanted to you know, make sure that he was the absolute best father he could be. That was his main focus for the most part. He wanted to be rich and a great dad.
Well, and, there you go.
he had ideals about all kinds of things, mostly religion and all-around intelligence. Like, he worked in the school system also eventually, and just had all kinds of ideas for how to teach children better, how to learn. He experimented on our son, with which actually has panned out very well for my sons. And just all-around knowledge seeker. So for our marriage, it was important to both of us that we learned together. Everything that he did, I wanted to do. I was in love with his personality and wanted to be everything he embodied, and was like, okay, well, if you're going to read this book, I'm going to read it too. If you're going to learn something new, I'm going to learn it too. If, you know, there's something about relationships that, you know, that you've found somehow, then tell me, and I want to bounce that back, you know, back and forth, and just grow together. So I guess our main focus was growing together.
It really does sound like it was a wonderful marriage, a wonderful relationship. And then there was that day in the park where something happened that ultimately changed your life and the lives of your, at that point, two sons. What was that?
So it was Easter Sunday, 8 years ago, and he was in a backward relay race with his family and friends, and kids were outside, and I was inside with my son, who was my youngest, who was a baby at the time. And my oldest, you know, was out there with him, and they were playing, and he comes running inside, and he's like, Mommy, you know, he's going to die. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, at the time, he's about 6 years old. And you know, I'm trying to get a straight sentence out of him, and it turns out Jason had been trying to avoid a child while he was running in this backward relay race, and one of them had run across the field while people were running. So in order to not trample him, he had kind of turned in such a way but tripped over a child and wound up hitting his head on the ground, and there was some random piece of asphalt, because it's all yard, you know, so there was a piece of asphalt in the ground. He hit his head and was mostly almost unconscious, and so I, you know, ran outside, and he called the ambulance, and in about a span of 30 minutes, he was gone from this earth. He was gone, and it changed my life completely.
How long had you been married at that point?
6 years.
So still very early on in your relationship. And literally in a flash, he was gone. Now, you talked about someone called the ambulance, and the ambulance sounds like they really took their time showing up.
Yeah, we were out in King William County, and if anyone knows about that area, it's a rural area in Virginia, and I'm thinking they may have gotten lost trying to find the house, because it was at a relative's house in their backyard, and it took them about 45 minutes to get there, and by then he was unconscious.
So the ambulance came, picked him up, took him to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
while we were en route to the hospital, I noticed not only were we going, we were taking the long way, it seemed, but where there was a bunch of commotion that you could see through the back window of the ambulance, because I was driving behind them, they had, you know, stopped. They were kind of just sitting. And we wound up going to a hospital that wasn't the closest one, and that raised some questions. But at the time, you know, I'm just, you know, riding and trying to stay calm. We did arrive to the hospital, though. I noticed that when they pulled him from the ambulance, there was a sheet over his face. So I, you know, gathered from, you know, never having to deal with this before, gathered from movies, I guess, that this must mean he was gone. But when we, you know, got there and got settled in, it actually took them about 2.5 hours to get to us and let us know what had happened and that he was, in fact, gone.
Tell us about that 2.5 hours. Who was there with you? What was going on? Where were your children?
My children were back at the house. I had gone to the hospital without them because I didn't know what to expect. My mom and dad had come down because, like I said, I'm from Maryland. So they, you know, I called them as soon as it happened, and they were on their way immediately and were there. They met me at the hospital when I got there. And his parents were there. A few people from the party were there, and we were just kind of sitting in a waiting room, just waiting. And it was the most excruciating. I didn't even have I couldn't even pray. I was so upset and so jarred. I didn't know what to pray for. I didn't know whether or not to pray that he be alive, because I knew that with that type of injury, he would no longer be himself. He would probably be a vegetable. And I didn't want to pray that he was gone, because he was my everything, and I didn't know what to tell my kids, and I didn't know what to do with my life. I felt like my life literally did not work without him in it. And so it was a very trying 2 hours. And when the nurse finally did come in and let us know, she was a younger nurse, and probably, I'm not sure what her experience was, but I express in the book my disdain for her, for the way she approached the subject. She had actually said that they had been able to restart his heart, and then revised what she said and meant that they had been unable to restart his heart. So it was kind of like a roller coaster of emotions in the span of 2 seconds.
That's a pretty big mistake.
It is.
And yes, you did express your irritation with the nurse. Very clearly, in Bounce Back Better. So here you are, you're 28 years old, and you are all of a sudden a single parent of two.
Yeah. That was not something I had planned on at all. I felt a lot of different things. I felt betrayed, and it's an odd feeling to have when, you know, of course he didn't do it on purpose. Of course he didn't have any, you know, any hand in that at all, but it's still one of the feelings when you go through grief. You know, you feel like, I did not sign up for this. What did I do to deserve something like this? And most importantly to me, what, you know, my kids, they deserved a dad like him. They deserved him.
And all of a sudden, through really no fault of anyone's, he was gone. Maya Tyler, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue, and I'm going to ask you what those early days were like on the other side of your husband's funeral.
Okay.
Folks, we will be back in just a moment. Maya, the name of your memoir is Bounce Back Better, How to Win After a Great Loss. But I'm pretty clear that in the moments and the days and the weeks after your husband's funeral, that was the last thing you were thinking about. What were those days and times like for you?
They were the worst days of my life. It was difficult to explain to my kids. Well, my youngest was, you know, wasn't even talking yet. So it was mostly my oldest, Justin, and my husband Jason. They were best friends. I mean, I didn't realize how difficult this would be to talk about right now.
Take your time.
He was his shadow. You know, he looked up to his dad. He loved his dad. And to have to explain to him was hard. It was very hard. I couldn't even bring myself to tell him exactly what had happened. I just let him know, well, you know, Daddy had to go to heaven. And he won't be back, but you'll see him again one day.
And how did Justin receive that?
I'm not sure if he did or not, as he's such an awesome kid. And even at six, it was almost as if I was talking to an adult, because I said to him, you know, I said, you know, Dad had to go. And he says, well, he's dead. And that, I think, had to be the worst and hardest sentence I'd ever heard in my life, come from my son. And
your six-year-old son.
My six-year-old son. And so to him, I couldn't say yes. I said, no, he's not. He just had to be somewhere else. And he, you know, thought it over for a moment, and he looked at me, and he didn't cry. He gave me a hug, and he said, okay, Mommy.
That's extraordinary. And tell us about what you went through in those early days.
Oh, I didn't do anything. I didn't eat. I didn't sleep. I didn't do anything. I pretty much discovered exactly how many times one can blow their nose in a day. I cried all day and all night for weeks.
For weeks?
For weeks.
And who was with you?
I didn't go to work. I didn't do anything. I could not believe that this was my reality. And I refused to believe that it was my reality. I kept thinking, you know what? I'm going to wake up and this is going to be fine. And that's a weird thing to say to, you know, another adult, or, you know, to actually go through something that feels like a nightmare. It's hard to explain to other people that you really do believe this is probably a dream. And it's hard to explain to people why you can't adapt to this new reality with quote fingers, you know. So I didn't explain it to anyone. I went into a very deep depression, and it brought on another, I was already dealing with anxiety disorder, which was not something I dealt with in my childhood. It was, I think, brought on as a side effect from some misdiagnosis. But it made it worse. And so I was having anxieties about going to sleep. I didn't think I was going to wake up. I was having anxieties about talking about my grief, because I felt like there was a black hole in it, that if I talked about it, if I opened up about it, and if I let it out, I was never going to come back. I was never going to be okay. So I kept it in. And that went on for a few months.
So it sounds like the anxiety and depression that is more than reasonable for anyone to experience, given the circumstances that you described, was in fact exacerbated by those circumstances because you were already sort of there. You were already dealing with depression and anxiety.
Yeah, I had suffered a bit of postpartum depression with both of my kids, which is characteristic of depression. You know, it comes and goes. But it was mostly, you know, something that that I was dealing with, but Jason was dealing with it with me. You know, he was the only person I had confided in about it, and the only person I trusted to talk about with, because I didn't feel like a therapist or medication or any of those things that are, you know, typically not part of the Black community's everyday culture. I didn't feel like I was, quote, fingers, crazy. So I didn't want to be treated that way. And now I was faced with dealing with this crazy by myself. And so it, yes, was exacerbated by his death because I felt like, okay, now where I was managing it and having someone to talk to about it, now I've got nothing.
And you were thrust into the unenviable position of being a single parent with not one but two children. I mean, it's hard enough being a double parent. Being a single parent is... Will you talk about it?
Baby in diapers.
Mm-hmm. So talk about those challenges, because, you know, now you didn't have any backups in terms of childcare, picking anybody up, you know, sort of co-parenting when your child comes home with what you can't believe they've come home with, but they learned it at school. How did you manage all that?
The first year I was not able to by myself because, like I said, I was not eating, sleeping. I wasn't taking care of myself. I was basically just existing, so I moved in with my parents. I had also lost the ability to afford my home, so I had to move in with my parents and try to appeal to a bank for some sort of, you know, mortgage relief. But, you know, with all that going on and living with your parents, feeling like a returned mail order bride, because now you have to come back to the place where you were given away from, it took away my liberties. It took away my my confidence in myself that I could do anything, you know, that I could parent by myself. I felt like I couldn't parent. I couldn't take care of my baby. You know, I felt very helpless and very hopeless. And it was difficult to regroup until I realized, okay, I need some help. And that was a very tough decision, too.
Sure. Did you have anyone around you talking to you about seeing a therapist or going to a support group or anything like that?
Oh, yes. My mom, you know, went at that conversation just about every day. And she, you know, would find, oh, my sister's cousin, brother, friend, and knows this therapist guy, and, you know, maybe hypnosis, maybe, you know, all kinds of interesting ideas. And I had refused all of them. I was like, I'm not crazy. I'm not going to the crazy town. I'm not talking with the crazy people. I'm not doing any of those things. So it was a conversation that went on and on and on for months. And then eventually, after a particularly acute episode of anxiety attack, I gave in. I tried a therapist who specialized in hypnosis. To tell you the truth, I'm not really sure whether or not that worked because I feel like I was cognizant during the entire session, but who knows? It didn't help in the long run, but who knows what actually happened in that office that day. I don't remember.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about hypnosis is that you are aware of what's going on. I mean, that's one of the the myths, you know, that people often think with hypnosis they're going to be put under and required to do all manner of things. But in fact, the fact that you were cognizant of your surroundings makes sense. But what it also sounds like was that was not, you know, that was not the approach for you for that moment. Were you going to hypnosis as a way to help deal with your grief?
It was a way to help deal with the anxiety, actually.
Okay.
I had still refused to confront the grief out loud.
Okay. So that didn't feel like a good fit for you?
No.
Now, a lot of times when people start working with a therapist and the first one doesn't feel like a good fit, they're done.
I was. I was, you know, convinced that this was, you know, a crock. It was not going to work for me. I wasn't the kind of crazy that was fixable. So the way I actually wound up having a therapist was in a roundabout way. My mother, she's sneaky, she got my son a therapist, which I felt was okay. That was acceptable to me because what my son did not, I was not sure whether he knew or not, but I believe he was the child that my husband tripped over.
Oh, my.
So, yes. So I did not want to ask him if he knew, and I didn't want any family member to accidentally tell him if he didn't know. So I needed a way to find out his recount of what happened, and so a therapist was a good fit.
Okay. So your mom was certainly diligent.
Yes. Yes, she was. She actually has a few degrees in behavioral education, so she was determined.
And it sounded like she used those degrees.
Yes, she did. So she was determined, and I'm thankful for her because she's my mom. She's the greatest. So I did wind up going in tandem with him, and I loved his therapist. I really did. Dr. Bernstein has since passed away, but... she was awesome. She helped him, or she talked to him, and she would play games with him. And while he's playing the games, she would talk to him, and it turns out that, no, he didn't know. Either that or he had blocked it, and she said and suppression would be something that would be expected if he did, and to just watch later. You know, she'll just watch his progress to make sure that, you know, if it did ever come back to the surface, she would help him deal with it. It since has not, so I'm not sure how to, you know, what happens if it does, but at this point in time, 8 years later, it hasn't. So
this is not an interview you want your son to hear?
No.
Gotcha. How are your boys doing today?
They're fine. They're awesome. Their kids are so resilient. They don't, you know, in the beginning things were rough where, you know, he was younger and I would think that he was doing things on purpose, like, oh, throw a fit because you don't like something mommy did. Oh, I'm going to say I want my daddy. You know, like, really?
Yeah.
And, you know, those types of things happen. But as he got older, and found his place in who he is and where he's comfortable, where, you know, yeah, he plays chess. My oldest plays chess and plays tennis and, you know, is an awesome student, great in math and reading, which is an anomaly to me. I was a reading and English person, and my husband was a math guy. So it's interesting and cool that he's got both of us. He's charming and he's his dad. He's his dad. He's charming and personable and kind, and it's almost hard to look at him sometimes because even though people say he looks like me, I see his dad.
Yeah.
And my youngest is a little mini him because even though if he could be a football, he would be because he's, you know, the athletic opposite of my oldest. He still is has some of the same personality traits where he's very caring, very intuitive, like, there was a time around when he was about three where he, you know, saw me and I was probably in one of my emotional moments. And he just kind of, 3-year-old, walks up to me and puts his hands on his shoulder and says, "Are you okay, Maya?" And I'm looking at him like, "Sir." So he's a very interesting little boy.
Indeed. Sounds like it. Now, you know, a lot of folks, when they have suffered the loss of a spouse or someone who, you know, lives in that role in their lives, they will choose to not date and see themselves as forever connected to that person who is now deceased. What were your thoughts and actions around the issue of dating? Did people try to insist that you date yesterday? Were folks leaving you alone? What were your thoughts?
There were a few fix-ups, you know, where people would say, maybe they gave me about a year, and then after that there were a couple of people, "Oh, I have a cousin who the same thing happened to him. His wife passed away and he's got 2 kids, or, you know, oh, there were a couple of those. And honestly, I really didn't have anything against beginning to date again. It just, it was one of those things that I had to, that I had to see that whether I was ready for it or not by trying it. And, you know, I dated a little and it didn't work out. people already have their misconceptions about, or their own ideas about how you are. They've already decided for you that people in that are going through grief and going through loss, that, oh, you're fragile, oh, you're going to compare me to this person, oh, you're never going to love me as much as, you know, you loved your husband, and all these things. And so there's a pressure to prove to them that your, quote, finger's over it. And I think that followed me around through my, you know, a couple of early relationships that I had, maybe a year or so after Jason passed. It was, you know, and I noticed it, that I was constantly hiding how I really felt about certain things. I had a rule where you couldn't even see my kids in person and know they exist, or know anything other than they exist until we've been together seriously for about a year. And that actually worked for me in my, and to my advantage. But it was, I was very defensive about being a widow. I was very defensive about, you know, needing anyone, or, you know, looking to be any of the things that I was stereotyped to be. You know, a lot of times single moms get the stereotype when you see a mom walking around with her 2 kids and she doesn't have a ring on. It's like, oh, she's somebody's baby's mom, or, you know, oh, you know, she's probably financially struggling and trying to, you know, get into your pockets, or, you know, she's going to need you, and all these things. And I was very defensive of those things, those stigmas, very aware of those stigmas. And so it was hard to date with those in mind, being offended every time a guy would say, you know, oh, so how many kids do you have? Do they have the same father? You know, things like that. So it was rough at
Wow.
first.
Yeah. People do say the darndest things, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Maya, Bounce Back Better, which is the name of your, you know, I've been referring to it as a memoir, but, you know, it's kind of like a memoir. It's kind of like a workbook. It's kind of like a self-help guide. Talk to us about Bounce Back Better.
So my book is about dealing with, it's about self-rehabilitation. It's about navigating through change, refocusing after trauma, and using visual organization. And while I was dealing with things like legal hurdles, you know, financial decisions, and mental health issues, I needed ways to be able to deal with those things in my right mind. And this book addresses people that are going through, you know, really traumatic things, and or even things that aren't on the same level, but still have them feeling and going through the steps of grief and loss. So I needed to, when I was going through these things, it was almost impossible to reset myself until I figured out how to refocus. And until I was actually able to use logical things, because when you go through grief and loss, and there's not knocking the religious community at all, there are, you know, people that tell you, oh, you know, religion and have faith, and you know you're gonna get through this, and it's gonna be all right. But nobody ever tells you how. Nobody does the okay, this is step one. And when I was going through what I was going through, I went through different books, different types of personal development seminars, and I realized, you know, all of these motivational books are great and they're motivating, but they're not telling me how, what my first step is. And I felt like there was a void there. And I also was able to take the personal development aspect of it from being part of network marketing companies with my husband. And I was like, you know, a lot of the things that I need to do are based on logical goal setting. And a lot of the things that the motivation I need is based on the personal development that I would have needed on the inside to get to these steps. And I started to use those things and pull them into one place and kind of organize them in a way that a person could use them practically for something as intangible as loss.
So for you, I know one of the points that you make several, I think, really important points in your book. One of them is that you found that there weren't as many resources or outlets, particularly for African-American persons and certainly African-American parents. And while Bounce Back Better is not just for African-Americans, your sense is that it does fill a need where a need certainly existed before Bounce Back Better. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay. In terms of where do you begin, where does one begin? Your life completely changed in 30 minutes.
Very much so. And where I had to start was to use an assessment. I really had to sit down, and that's one of the principles in the book that it goes through, three different principles. And the first is your assessment. You have to sit down and figure out, okay, what is it that I have? What is it that I need? And, you know, what's my inventory, pretty much? And that's where you start.
So you literally start with making a list.
Yes.
Looking at mm-hmm. yourself and making some honest lists. Mm-hmm. Do you need help from other folks to make the list?
You can enlist help. In my case, I didn't. Well, in my case, the listing was inspired by my therapist. She asked a couple of really good questions, and it moved me to want to put them on paper and apply them to the things that that I had learned with listing and organization and network marketing.
One of the tasks, if you will, that you have with Scratchpad and Scratchpad, why don't you describe Scratchpad to the listeners?
So Scratchpad is my left-brained way of kind of bringing people with me. The experience in Bounce Back Better is one of those self-actualization experiences where I'm basically figuring out how to realize my own potential, but I'm experimenting with myself in order to get there. So what I wanted people to do is not just read, you know, something from cover to cover and, you know, not get to exercise their thoughts on what was going on in the book and how to apply that to their own lives at each step. So the scratch pad was, okay, we just learned this. I just talked about this. Now let's apply it to your own life. Let's see what you can do at this moment, without having to be finished the book. You know, let's pull together what we're going to do about you and why you're reading this book in the first place, you know.
And, you know, one of the things about grief, certainly, is that if you try to pull everything all together right now, that's not happening. So taking it a step at a time, that's absolutely the way to go.
Yes, I definitely felt that way. Grief can be very overwhelming, especially when you're dealing with loss, because the foundation of whatever it was that was, you know, your center is gone now. So you, things begin to crumble around you, and it can be very overwhelming with where to start, which thing to start with, and what exactly you need to do. So step-by-step was the best way for me.
All right, so what was the next thing you did after the self-assessment?
So after the assessment, there was, kind of have to go back a bit, because the assessment really is the second step. The first real step is the acceptance,
Okay. Accepting
that this happened to you, and, and going through, okay, this is not a dream. So that's more of a conceptual step. The actual first step, okay, physically would be the assessment. And then the next thing that you would go through to be is how do you acquire these things that you've decided in your assessment that you need? You know, you would need a plan. You would need to know the environment that you need to be in to get to wherever it is you're trying to go. You need to know there's a bit of a list of things that would help you get from point A to point B.
So if I'm now sitting with your book and working on my initial assessment, what kinds of things am I assessing? Am I looking at my finances? Am I looking at my friends? Am I looking at my physical health? Am I looking at, you know, today I'm 5'5", but really tomorrow I'd like to be 5'10"? I mean, what kinds of things go into my initial assessment of me?
Okay. So assessing your situation, I guess you would have to start with a total assessment. You would start with, okay, what am I right now? Who am I right now? What would I describe myself as? What would people say, you know, about me? What would I, you know, exactly make an accurate assessment of what's going on in your life right now. And, you know, I kind of give an example about, you know, if you could make the decision, or you could make an assessment of what was going on around you at every situation, you may decide to do something different than your initial reaction. You know, for example, if you had a ball coming at your face, you know, if you could pause time and make an assessment of your present situation, you could think, oh, maybe I have time to move out of the way. Maybe I can cover my face. Maybe I can catch it. And that's the type of thinking I want to give people, you know, let them know that even though this thing happened to you at full speed, you can still sit, take a moment, and make an assessment of what you can do next, what's really happening, and look at it in black and white. So there's that total assessment. You know, you kind of have what's going on with you, what physically, what mentally. Do you need to, you know, in my journey, I actually did both assessments of mental assessment. Okay, eventually I went to a therapist to kind of see, you know, make sure, okay, do I need medication? Do I need, yoga? What do I need mentally? And then you figure out, okay, you go to actual doctor, make sure there's nothing physically wrong with you. Okay, what do I need here? And that was just my journey. Maybe, you know, someone else may not need to go to a doctor. But in the stages of grief, I know that through my own experience and dealing with, you know, talking to other people going through the same thing, you physically feel lost. And sometimes you need to make sure that that's what it is that you're physically feeling. And that, you know, it's not something more complicated that could be compounded over time. So, you know, the assessments are mental and physical, and, you know, the just a total assessment of your life.
Talk a little bit more about the experience of being Black and female and a single parent, particularly of two boys, in the world in which we live today?
So it's just different, you know, being a single mother of color. It seems that, you know, we have it, you know, particularly hard, significantly in this arena, because, like I was saying before, it tends to warrant attacks on our characters. our self-esteem, our financial situations. You know, when you see a single mom who's a black mom, you automatically assume that, you know, she's either divorced or has some deadbeat dad as her child's father. You don't assume, oh, she was actually married and her husband passed away. No one has ever made that assumption when they realize I have children, when they're, you know, trying to date me or just in passing conversation. No one ever makes that assessment that I was married when I had my children. And that in itself, that statement, you know, it says a lot.
So not only do you have all the things that are going on with you emotionally about the loss and your new way in the world, and it's 360 degrees new and different, but you also have the challenge of what other people assume about you, knowing nothing about you.
Exactly.
And you're saying that that's more, potentially more difficult with women of color than not.
I do believe that. I've never been a woman that's not of color, but you know, assessing from the experiences that I've had, I've noticed that that's a norm in our community. That, you know, not only are we single mothers, that there's an assumption and sometimes the reality of having financial issues, and there's the reality of dealing with self-esteem. Because, like I said, no one takes you for a widow. No one takes you for, and not to say that there's more esteem in having been married before you had your children, but it's just a flat assumption that, you know, you were okay with, I guess, the idea of having a bunch of kids without, you know, and then there's the stigma about, you know, raising boys, where no one believes that you can do it on your own. It's, you know, common knowledge, I guess, that you would say that, oh, you know, a boy without a man in the home is not going to somehow be able to succeed as well, that mom cannot be his, you know, what his dad would have been for him. So there's a lot of pressure to be both parents. There's a lot of pressure to be able to financially provide and to financially survive. And I think that when you look at single parents in our world, in our society, a lot of the times the ones that are successful and the ones that are, you know, doing things like really living life and being happy and are, you know, learning Tai Chi and doing yoga and traveling abroad and all those homeschooling things, they aren't normally minority women. They aren't normally black women. Normally we are, you know, tend to be more absorbed in tangible basic needs like, you know, work, kids, bills, occasionally vacation, church, repeat. You know, we may watch Oprah, we may cry with Ayanla, we might, you know, see these self-help things happening on a level where that person has the money and time to do those things. But in our community, it begs the question of whether or not it's practical and, you know, how much it costs and whether or not we have time to access therapists or create therapeutic habits or reach our potentials and self-actuate. How much it costs and whether we have this time plays a significant factor in the practicality of living better or more satisfying lives.
So for the person who goes to bouncebackproject.com, a couple of questions. Is it for women only?
No.
Okay. And I think we've already made clear that it's not solely for women of color.
No.
So what am I going to do when I go to bouncebackproject.com? What's there for me?
At this point in time, it is a repository for blogs that I've written about, you know, setting goals, making change, renewing, you know, belief in yourself and your capabilities. I have created a group of women that, you know, a forum where we talk about our stories, exchange, and it isn't for just women, but it seems to be a thing that mostly women are attracted to. So there are a few men I've had who have read my book, and, you know, have glowing things to say, you know, about how they were dealing with loss in different ways, where, you know, they may have lost a child or they may have lost a job. And in both of those ways, they were still able to see the loss portion and then see the change portion and apply the change portion, the refocusing, the listing, the goal setting, and be able to apply that to their lives. So, like I said, it's not it doesn't exclude non-Black women, and it doesn't exclude men, but it tends to grab that community that doesn't tend to show up when it comes to the self-help community.
Understood.
What I mean by that is, you know, what I went around and did was, while I was going through the things that I was going through, I noticed that, and after I had written the book, I noticed that a lot of the women who were emailing me were going through the same things I was going through, where they, you know, needed legal help or financial help or mental health help, and they were all dealing with these things while they were trying to deal with change, trauma, and organization issues. So I'm thinking, oh man, there should be some sort of group for widows, you know, to teach them about the paperwork, or for single moms to teach them about the financial help they could be getting, or, you know. And so when I looked, however, what I found was I found two groups that were, you know, in my immediate area, but neither of them had included the predominantly Black community, which is PG County. They have chapters in both organizations, and there were no chapters in PG County.
And that's Prince George's County in Maryland.
Yes.
So in noticing a particular absence of options in that particular area, it sounds like that too added to your real commitment to creating the Bounce Back Project and making it available to others. Maya, I have to thank you so much for the time that you've spent with us today, for sharing your story and your life. And hopefully lots of folks will join you on bouncebackproject.com.
Yes, that would be thebouncebackproject.com. And I certainly hope to see people reading and sharing along with me.
Wonderful. Again, thank you, Maya, very much for joining us today on Mind Talk.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can follow the Mind Talk podcast through iTunes. You can download the Mind Talk app through iTunes. So there are lots of options, lots of places to go where you can hear us every day on demand. I would also like to let you know that if you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that email address is pamela@mindtalk.org. And finally, I'd like to remind you, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.